We have worked very hard to create a very comprehensible, very hands-on and fun seminar for all of you. So first, I would like to introduce you to the organizing team, Hanna Posti-Ahokas, Marianne Jaakola, Panu Forsman, I can't see him here, Salla Matta, Josephine Moat, and I'm Victoria Edes. Before we get started, I would like to say a few words about practicalities before and throughout the seminar. We have our wonderful volunteers here. They are all wearing beautiful orange shirts. They are here to answer all of your questions and to help you with anything. We also have Pime Cafe open throughout the seminar from 11 till 4 every day. It is a wonderful organization who are working with people who are blind or they have visual impairments, and they are providing an opportunity to experience their world. So please go and visit the room. I forgot to...
A210.
There are signposting, and we'll have volunteers who will guide you there as well. We also have a flinger going all throughout the seminar where we would like you to put up your ideas, your observations, any questions that you would like any of our presenters to answer or us to answer. The code for it is FK4YELR, all block capitals. And this will be going all throughout the seminar, and we will have the opportunity throughout the seminar to look at the questions, and if there's something relevant, we'll try to answer it as soon as possible. We are also on social media. We have a Facebook event page where our social media officer will be posting regular updates in form of pictures and thoughts about the highlights of what is happening currently. There is an opt-out option, so if you would not like to be present in the pictures and you have noticed that there was a picture taken of you, it is okay to go to the person and ask them, please, can you not include me in this picture? We also have wonderful workshops, 9 of them, and you have, I hope, signed up for something that really, really interests you. If you have not done so, there is an opportunity to sign up after this session. This session is titled Building Bridges, Not Walls, and it is the national launch of the Global Monitoring Report 2019, which is titled Migration, Displacement and Education. We will have presentations from this area from around the globe. The presenters include Professor Maria-Lena Laxo, who will officially open the session and the seminar. Mr. Bilal Barakat from UNESCO will be joining us online through Skype, and he will present us with the main points of the Global Monitoring Report. Then we have Satu Pehuvoima representing the Finnish Ministry for Foreign Affairs, and she will talk about Finland's commitment and goals and implementation of the Global Monitoring Report. Then Elina Lehtomäki from University of Oulu and Mary Helsten from Stockholm will be commenting on the report. Gloria Lapitan from Monikulturikeskus Gloria, or Gloria Multicultural Center from Jyväskylä, will talk about how these sustainable migration practices are present and how are they provided in the local third sector organization. And finally, Mary Helsten from Stockholm University we'll be talking about sustainable internationalization of higher education. I hope you'll have a wonderful seminar. And now I would like to give way to Professor Maria-Elena Laakso.
Dear participants of this 2019 SDG4 seminar, the pleasure of opening this great event has once again been given to me. I'm so happy and honored to have this task and the opportunity to wish you all very warmly welcome to the most interesting and important seminar. This SDG4 seminar is one of the events that recur on a regular basis in our university. For me, this seminar, this event, is definitely one of my absolute favorites. The reasons are, of course, the theme and the program, but even more so, you, the participants. Every time I have stood here in front opening the seminar, I have deeply enjoyed knowing the richness and diversity of perspectives and experiences that you have brought here with you. I feel so grateful that despite of all the differences between us, we all share the deep desire to make the world equal, more tolerant, and more sustainable place to live. This is already the 9th time our university, and especially the Faculty of Education and Psychology, organizes this event. Until year 2014, it was arranged under the concept of Education for All. And from 2015 on, when the United Nations launched the Sustainable Development Goals, it has been SDG4 seminar. In my view, this is now an excellent place to give warm applause to all the people who have been responsible for arranging these seminars during the past years, and mostly to you who have borne the responsibility for the arrangements of this year, especially to you, our international and national students. Thank you so much. Dear audience, I would also like to express my deepest appreciations to all our colleagues and friends from other universities and other countries, near and very far, for taking your time and making extra effort to participate and contribute to our seminar. I wish you all most warmly welcome, especially we cherish the long relationships and inspiring and rewarding cooperation we have had with the universities and scholars from Stockholm, Helsinki, Oulu, North Carolina, Wilmington, and Winnipeg, Sarajevo, and many other organizations and institutions. We also owe many thanks to UNESCO and our Ministry of Foreign Affairs for most productive collaboration and for working with us to organize these seminars. The theme of this year, SDG4 seminar, is Education for Sustainable Development. Finland, among other countries, is committed to implement the Global Sustainable Development Goals, and one of them is Quality Education for All. In the specification of the Goal 4, Target 4.7, it is stated that by 2030, we ensure that all learners acquire the knowledge and skills needed to promote sustainable development, including sustainable lifestyles, human rights, gender equality, promotion of a culture of peace and nonviolence, global citizenship, and appreciations of cultural diversity. The concept of sustainability is very broad and demanding one. Within this framework, we need to acknowledge both environmental and economical, as well as social and cultural aspects of sustainability. In universities and all other educational institutions, we are committed to ensure that all these aspects of sustainability are covered and most preferably embedded into our course contents and curricula. Crucial question to us as education providers is, how do we safeguard that these commitments are not only empty words? And what are the very concrete actions we are going to take, or in one sense, we should have already taken. In a small book by Greta Thunberg, this brilliant, brave, and persistent young heroine writes, "Some people say that we are not doing enough to fight climate change. But that is not true, because to not do enough, you have to do something. And truth is, we are basically not doing anything." Young Greta's views concerning global actions for climate change are quite strong and somewhat pessimistic. However, despite this quite merciless statement, she definitely has not given up, but acts bravely and tirelessly to convince us all that no one is too small to make a difference. I think it's important for us that we honestly admit that there is very, very much work to do, but at the same time, we have to believe that we have the tools and we have the power to influence, and we need to act together. Dear participants, this year's Global Education Monitor report that will be officially launched after these opening words opens our eyes to the vast and multifaceted challenges, yet again also opportunities, migration and displacement generates for our educational system and policies. It also gives hope for educational actions by analyzing how education can build inclusive societies, help people move beyond tolerance and learn to live together. In the report, there are encouraging examples, for example, on how more and more countries have modified their curricula and textbooks to reflect growing social diversity. Here in our university, we have just finished our strategy, Wisdom and Wellbeing for Us All, and starting to implement our strategic development program for education, Academic Experts with Social Impact. At the same time, we are in the middle of preparing our curricula for the next three-year period. In all these documents, we have committed to the values and principles of sustainable development goals. In our educational strategy program, we have given a promise to organize our education so that all students graduating from our university have the possibility to acquire competencies for taking responsibility for the well-being of themselves and of others, including global and ethical responsibility. This is not a light promise, but definitely it's doable. In EAIA conference newsletter, young scholar Joanna Romanovic, an international programs manager for sustainability at the UK's National Union of Students, writes that unconnected modules on the environment are less effective than more fundamental transformations of curricula. She argues that sustainability themes can be introduced in all subjects from languages and history to dentistry. Reaching this goal requires that in all study programs, teachers and researchers, together with students and other stakeholders, set the learning goals for sustainability and responsibility and modify the curricula to meet these goals. One important aspect in this work is outreach activity through which we build relationships and engage with community issues. When working towards these goals in study programs, departments and faculties definitely need university-wide support and resources. When we are considering education for sustainability, it's not only curricula and study contents we are talking about. It has been said that example is one of the most effective ways to educate. That means that we, as an educational organization, have to act responsibly with regard to, for example, food consumption, waste reduction, energy use, renewable materials, infrastructure, buildings, reconstruction, transportation, and so on. In our new strategy, these issues are clearly included in the strategic goals of our campus development program. Ladies and gentlemen, one aspect of sustainability I have not yet tackled is the social dimension of the concept. If we are committed to education for sustainability, we also have to ensure that our university addresses the needs of all learners and provides a safe place for studying and working for people with different cultural or ethnic backgrounds, gender and sexual orientations, handicaps or learning difficulties. That entails that we have clear guidelines, effective action plans, and as well as reliable and sensitive ways of gathering information and identifying all potential deviations from our high standards for equality and accessibility of education. Reaching this goal for social sustainability also requires that we continuously educate our staff members. Social and cultural aspects of sustainability are essential part of our student life concept, which consistent development is included in our education development program, and we also address these issues in our strategic development program for university community. All this shows that in our University of Jyväskylä, we determinedly strive to educate our students and construct our learning and working community for sustainability. Cross-cutting all these strategic development programs, we have established a working group for sustainability and responsibility that operates under the quality assurance, targeting to bring all the different goals and actions in these development programs together. As a tool for reporting these actions, we have decided to adopt Times High Education Impact Ranking. Times High Education University Impact Rankings capture universities' impact on society based on institutions' success in delivering the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. We believe that monitoring our actions within this framework helps us to be in track both on our success and on the challenges we still have to conquer. Before ending, I want to share with you an inspiration I got in this year, EAIE, difficult to say, conference, which means European Association for Internationalization in Higher Education, if I remember correctly. One of the keynote speakers was government advisor Simon Anholt, who had invented the Good Country Index. This is a measure that tells us what each country on earth contributes to the common good of humanity and what it takes away relative to its size. In his keynote speak, he argues that when people of his, and so also my, generation say that we are going to fix the global crisis facing our planetary well-being, we are telling a lie. Our generation is definitely part of the reason why we have ended in this kind of situations. But according to Simon Anholt, we are not the ones who can fix it. However, he argues that we can be part of the solution. The logic behind his words is that there are two reasons why we have ended up to these situations. At the same time, these reasons are also the keys to solutions. The reasons are, one, the way countries behave, and two, the way people behave. According to Simon Anholt, it's too late or it's impossible to profoundly change the attitudes and deeply rooted ways of behaving of this generation. But our hope is the next generation. In the end of his speech, he launched Good Generation Act. That means that we who are responsible for education should very early on educate our children to become global citizens, not domestic citizens. He initiated Good Generation Project, where he encourages us in all high education institutions and all education institutions to start the big conversation, where we at the end jointly agree on key values for global citizenship, commit to these, and define our education goals and curricula based on these. And then, when we have founded our future education on this very basis, we will witness the rise of the new good generation. In his words, we all humans are eventually just one tribe, and we should sit around the same campfire and solve our crises together. I think that in this seminar, during these two seminar days, you and we are sitting around the shared and hopefully warming and inspiring campfire, and we will be part of this big conversation, developing the basis for a more sustainable education and the foundations for the new good generation. I wish you all truly inspiring seminar days and stimulating conversations around the global campfire for sustainable education. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, sorry. Before we join Bilal online, we would like to play a short video for you.
Do you see this classroom? In it, there are pupils from all over. Each is different. This boy comes from a village. His family traveled to this town to find work. He does not know how to get around in the city yet. Her parents move from another country for work. They send money to their family back home. She is excited about the opportunities in this school. This boy came here to escape conflict. His world was turned upside down. He is seeking normality. Education is central to people's decisions to move, but their education is also at risk once they have moved. Their education needs are often overlooked in data collection, planning, and budgeting. First, we must recognize their rights to education no matter where they're from. Ease up on the paperwork. Treat migrants and refugees as you treat their hosts. Don't segregate them into different schools and slower school tracks or long preparatory courses. They need to interact with their peers. Put yourself in these families' shoes. Give them language and catch-up classes. Help them fit in. Update your curricula and textbooks to reflect history and culture. Don't misrepresent migrants and refugees or their reasons for leaving. Teachers are not superheroes. Train them to teach crowded, multilingual classrooms and those who have suffered trauma. This may be stressful. Help them cope. Make it easier to recognize people's qualifications and previous learning. Don't waste their potential. Bridge immediate funds for refugees with long-term funds for education systems. Because education really makes a difference. It builds people's resilience and sense of belonging. It opens our minds to different cultures, helps all of us face the unknown. In a world of increasing diversity, a good quality education teaches us these are all pupils, no matter their background.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Bilal Barakat, a senior policy analyst with the Global Education Monitoring Report. And I'm It's my great pleasure to present some of the findings of our 2019 report on migration, displacement, and education to you. Just to confirm, can you see the presentation?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So I would like to thank our hosts for the invitation. I'm very much looking forward to the discussion with you today.
So we cannot see the presentation.
You can't?
No, not... No.
Good, and it dropped, or...?
Yes. Okay. Could we also have a picture of you, please?
I have both, but let's see. Okay. Can you see the presentation now?
Yes.
Oh?
Yes, we can.
Okay. And can you still see it?
Yes.
So, no. Fulfilling its mandate to monitor progress on education in the SDGs, the report shows just how far the world still has to go to reach the targets that were agreed for 2030. One of the key challenges is to fulfill the commitment to leave no one behind. Among those groups who may be left behind, in particular, are migrants, refugees, and internally displaced people.
Sorry, we cannot see any picture. And we can't see the presentation, and we can't see you either.
But you could see it before?
Yes.
And it disappeared?
Yes.
That's odd. I didn't do anything on my end. Okay.
Is there anyone who's very versed in Skype who could help us?
What if you just send you the presentation by email and then you go
through it? Tell you what, I'll try first. I'm not going to go to full screen mode. I will just...
Yes.
You're back.
Okay. Do you see it now?
Yeah, let's keep it small.
Yes.
Okay. Does that work?
Yes.
Still?
It has dropped again.
Dropping, doesn't it?
Yes. We had some trouble starting your presentation. Please try again.
Okay. That didn't happen when we tested it.
No.
Did it? So, do you want to open the file I sent? And
yes. Could we freeze? That's frozen.
All right.
I'm so sorry.
And I'll just say next for the transitions.
Yes. I think just a second, I'm opening your presentation.
The report after next will be about technology and education.
Of course. Yeah.
Lovely. Yes, thank you very much. Yes, we are at the opening slide.
Okay, next, please. So, as I was saying, among those groups who are particularly vulnerable to being left behind are migrants, refugees, and internally displaced people who want to escape poverty or persecution. They may be seeking better education, employment opportunities, or just security. We have taken the widest possible interpretation of migration, including both voluntary and forced. The report covers internal migration. Estimated 1 in 8 people around the world live in a different province to the one they were born in. Apart from those who move from villages to cities, there are also hundreds of millions who move regularly as seasonal workers or nomads. The report addresses international migrants, who are nationals of one country living in another. They make up 257 million, or about 1 in 30 people. This doesn't even include the children of immigrants, the so-called second generation, for whom the education challenges can be similar. And last but not least, the report looks at the 1 in 80 people who have been displaced due to conflict or natural disaster, whether internally or across borders, as refugees or asylum seekers. The daunting prospect of displacement due to climate change is only briefly touched upon, because this is not a report on migration and displacement per se. It's a report on how these movements interact with education. It's about how teachers and education planners respond. It's about the need that migrants and refugees have for education to thrive in their new homes, to feel like they belong. Next. So migration and displacement can have both negative and positive effects on education systems. Let's start with the challenges. Next. Next, I think. I can't see your screen, so I'm guessing. Migration leads to millions of children of migrating parents to be left behind. More than 1 in 3 children were left behind in rural China in 2015. Urbanization and related demographic changes lead to large-scale school consolidation, including in many middle-income countries. Half of all rural schools closed in China and in the Russian Federation in the last 10 to 15 years. But also in Europe, we found that between 25% and 33% of primary and lower secondary schools in Norway and Sweden that had fewer than 100 students closed between 2006 and 2017, and still 30% of public schools have fewer than 100 students. In Finland, almost 80% of the schools with fewer than 50 students closed, more than 1,600 schools in all since 1990. Next. International, we're still on the same slide, yes? It's just a transition?
We are on a slide with the planet, and there are some...
Back, please. Sorry. Are you getting transitions, or is everything appearing at once?
I am getting transitions.
So on the international migration, it affects sending countries' education systems, particularly some of the smaller ones. So in 1 in 5 skilled people emigrated in 27% of countries. Next to the displacement bullet. So displacement particularly affects low-income countries. For 10% of the global population, but for 20% of the refugee population. And refugees, even more so than other migrants, are likely to be of school age. Half of all refugees are under 18. And they often arrive in parts of the host countries that already have poor education. Next slide.
Yes.
Yes. But apart from the challenges, migration and displacement also represent an opportunity. Next. So children who move from rural to urban areas often acquire more education than those who stay in rural areas. In Indonesia, that gap was 3 years. Next. Children of international migrants also tend to benefit, generally. So there's the example of Colombian immigrants to the U.S., whose children had 2 more years of education than the children of people who did not migrate. And when we talk of migrants, that also includes students studying abroad. And that's at least 6% of students in half of all countries. Next. And refugees, they may be leaving their homes, but they're also leaving insecurity behind. There were over 12,000 attacks on schools between 2013 and 2017 in conflict-affected countries. Next slide. Conversely, education is a powerful factor shaping migration flows. So the higher the education level, the higher the probability of migration. Those with tertiary education are twice as likely to migrate from villages to cities and 5 times as likely to emigrate abroad compared to those with primary. And what's often missed in public debates is that with relatively few exceptions, immigrants are actually tend to be more educated than natives on average, even in countries that don't necessarily have selective immigration policies. And finally, education itself is a critical, if a contentious, factor shaping attitudes towards immigration. So one 2017 survey covering 140 countries showed that the higher the level of education, the higher the level of openness to immigration levels staying the same or increasing. Next slide. But the role of education is even more important than what those relationships suggest. Next. So an inclusive education system, among other things, it can address causes of tension by helping host and immigrant communities interact and live together, or by providing equal opportunities. It can help immigrants and refugees realize their potential, which is often wasted. And ultimately, it can help immigrants and refugees earn a living and support communities back home through remittances and other mechanisms. Next. And so, speaking to remittances, the report shows that if the cost of remitting money fell from an average of 7%, as it currently is, to the SDG target of 3%, then $1 billion could be generated annually for education. Okay, thanks. The importance of these relationships is reflected in the fact that education-related commitments also made their way into the two global compacts on migrants and refugees that were signed almost a year ago at this point. But the question is how those commitments should be achieved and what are priority actions. Right? And the report is all about trying to identify those levers. And so we make 7 recommendations. Next. Thank you. So the governments need to protect the right to education of all people on the move. Just 2 years after the New York Declaration, where countries committed to providing education to refugees within 3 months of arrival, 1.5 billion school days of refugees have been lost. And in countries ranging from Australia to Hungary, from Indonesia, Mexico, for example, they're still providing limited or no education to asylum-seeking children in detention. And in Europe, while the Netherlands, Poland, and Slovakia provide education regardless of the length of stay, in other European countries, including Finland, as far as we could tell, children in immigrant detention actually have little access to education on the grounds that their stay is of short length or of exceptional nature. Next. And so is need to protect migrants and refugees' right to education regardless of documentation or residence status. Jordan tackled that after initial obstacles and allowed Syrian refugee children to enter public schools without ID cards. That change was made in 2016, for example. Next. Education and immigration laws should be made consistent with each other. Next. There should be no discretion in interpreting laws at local level so that school principals can deny access even though the law grants it. And next, finally, there should be formal processes in place to inform migrants and refugees of their right to education and to respond to violations of that right. Next slide, please. Secondly, migrant and refugee children need to be included in national education systems. So Turkey, for example, committed to include all Syrian children in public schools as opposed to refugee schools by 2020. Next. So refugees should spend as little time as possible in schools that don't follow the national curriculum. 8 of the top 10 refugee-hosting countries already include refugees in national education systems, including countries such as Chad or Ethiopia. Next. And immigrants shouldn't be segregated. They should not be concentrated in specific schools like they are in many European countries. They should spend as little time as possible in preparatory classes. Inclusion means interacting with their peers, and they shouldn't be separated or channeled into slower, often vocational tracks, because that compromises their future opportunities. Okay, next slide, please. But including migrants and refugees in national education systems is only the start. There has to be a plan to respond to their needs. And not all countries do this equally successfully. Can you see the graph? So yes. The graph shows countries in southern and eastern Europe, those highlighted in red, they're struggling to prioritize the needs of migrants and refugees in education. Next. An important factor is that countries need to provide language programs. Finland is actually exemplary in that respect, and among OECD countries, Finland has the highest share of immigrant students receiving language support, namely 80%. Unfortunately, at the same time, Finland has the biggest gap in reading performance in PISA between natives and non-natives. Partly that might be because of linguistic distance, which is particularly large. So speaking of adult illiterate learners, there was one study that found that even 1,400 hours of language and literacy course wasn't efficient to achieve functional reading. Next. Countries need to provide accelerated education programs, especially where education trajectories have been interrupted. So, for example, the Norwegian Refugee Council runs an accelerated program in the Dadaab refugee camp, where Kenya's eight-year basic curriculum is condensed into 4 years to allow refugee children to catch up. Next. Refugees need support to overcome cost barriers. So in Lebanon, for example, cash transfers increased attendance by 20%. And next, finally, adult migrants need financial education to support them managing remittances. Next slide, please. Thank you. Fourthly, countries should grapple with their curricula and textbooks. Education can challenge prejudice and develop skills for living together. But only a quarter of high-income countries have fully included multicultural education, and a little over two-thirds have done so, at least partially. The quarter that have done so fully includes Finland, alongside Ireland, New Zealand, and Sweden. So there's a gap there, with two-thirds of high-income countries only partially reflecting multiculturalism in curricula, even though the Eurobarometer survey, for example, shows that over 80% of respondents agreed that school materials should include information on ethnic diversity. And adapting curricula and textbooks involves respecting both past history and current diversity. It means recognizing the contributions of immigrants and refugees. And it involves promoting openness to multiple perspectives and encouraging critical approaches. Next slide. One key to overcoming those challenges is to support teachers who are burdened with very complex responsibilities facing migrants and refugees and other people on the move in classrooms. So in Syria, for example, almost three quarters of teachers had no training on providing psychosocial support. So it's necessary to train teachers to deal with diversity, to confront stereotypes and discrimination, to recognize stress and trauma, and then refer those who need specialist support on. And it's necessary to recognize the hardship under which some of the teachers are expected to work. So in Iraq, for example, fragmented support to IDP teachers ended up leading to pay disparities and then resulting tensions. The education cluster brought all the partners together to coordinate the incentives for teachers. Next slide. Unfortunately, the skills of migrants are often not fully deployed, despite their potential to contribute to host communities and societies. So in high-income countries, among those with tertiary education, immigrants were much more likely to be overqualified for their jobs. Next. So one way to address such challenges is to reform institutions to make the recognition of qualifications earned abroad more efficient. And that means streamlining and simplifying systems for certifying skills that were acquired informally. Germany, for example, offers opportunities to identify and evaluate undocumented occupational competencies, and Norway has a similar system. Next slide. All of this has cost implications. In the case of immigrants overall, the medium to long-term fiscal impact is actually fairly small. Once you take into account not just the services that immigrants use, but also taxes they pay, almost all the estimates end up in the range of within give or take 1% of GDP. But more could be done to target the funds where they are needed most. Next, so in the case of refugees, the report has estimated that $800 million were spent on refugee education in 2016, and that was roughly equally split between immediate-term humanitarian aid and long-term response development aid. And both of these should be planned jointly with the government that's in charge. Uganda is a best practice example for this recently. The momentum around education cannot wait. Perhaps could be used to further that. Education planning shouldn't just occur siloed in the education sector, but a multi-sector planning should take place. All right, next slide, please. So those were the seven recommendations relating specifically to migration and displacement. But the financing brings us to the wider challenges of education financing. Next. So one analysis we did for the report shows huge disparities. So low-income and high-income countries have approximately the same size school-age population overall, but only 0.5% of total global education spending is spent in low-income countries, and 65% is spent on a school-age population of a similar size in high-income countries. And their second graph. And the spending also needs to more equitable in other ways. Ironically, households in low-income countries bear a larger share of education expenses than households in high-income countries do. Next slide. And finance is important. It does make a difference. Next. So the mobilization of the international community that led to an increase in aid in the late 1990s is one of the factors that's credited with the gains that were made towards universal primary completion in the early 2000s. But the financial crisis led to aid stagnation, and then we see that primary completion rates then also started stagnating a bit less than 90% since the late 2000s. Next. So today, our agenda is even more ambitious. We're aiming for universal secondary completion. But currently, not even half, just under half complete secondary school globally, and just 18% in low-income countries, and just 1% of poorest girls around the world complete secondary school at the moment. But even in high-income countries in Europe, young people of a migrant background are twice as likely to leave school early compared to natives. Okay, we might have missed a couple of transitions there. Okay, so next slide. But our agenda is even more ambitious than that. Going beyond sort of school completion, and the aim is for everyone to also at least achieve a minimum level of learning. Next. So among first-generation immigrant students in the OECD, on average, they were a third less likely than natives to achieve basic skills in reading, maths, and science in 2015. We're looking forward to the PISA 2018 results to see how maybe that has changed. Next. In middle-income and non-OECD high-income countries, progress is very slow. So on average, the share of grade 4 students reaching minimum reading levels has increased by less than 1 percentage point per year over the last 15 years. So at this rate, it would take decades, basically, to reach the goal. And next, and finally, in low-income countries, they start from an even lower starting point. In Sierra Leone, The latest UNICEF mixed survey shows that among children, only 16% had basic reading skills and only 12% had basic numeracy. So ambitious as it may be, but the monitoring framework of SDG 4 helps keep our attention focused on what matters to achieve sustainable development, and that includes a focus on groups such as refugees and migrants who are at risk of falling behind. Final slide. So we welcome you to share the messages of the report widely. On the next slide, the final slide, if we're seeing it already, yes. So at those at that link, you'll find report materials in multiple languages and formats, including videos, and we'll actually watch another video sort of really bringing to life some of these issues through interviews with affected communities in a moment now, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Nearly. Yes, I am.
Our world is experiencing the biggest migration of people in history, from villages to cities, and from one country to another. Some choose to move.
Mon papa est venu ici quand il était jeune pour ses études.
Because of the difficulty of living in the Philippines, my parents felt compelled to leave.
जब हमारी मम्मी और पापा मतलब गावी सोड़ने निकले होते हैं.
Others are forced.
Çünkü biz savaş nedeniyle travma yaşamış, yakınlarını kaybetmiş öğrencilerle çalışıyoruz.
People on the move do not leave their rights to an education behind.
I believe that it is a constitutional right for a child to be educated, and we need to respect that right.
We've had parents arrested for deportation, which obviously affected the school and the population.
I'm afraid that one day out of the blue, my dad will be gone or my mom will be gone.
It is a constitutional obligation to not abridge access to public education for any child, irregardless of immigration status.
Migrants and refugees have unique education needs.
El reto más grande para los niños refugiados cuando ingresan al sistema escolar nuestro está precisamente en empezar a acoplarse a ese mundo escolar que es muy diferente.
But when education systems can adapt to these needs, they have the potential to transform lives.
Due to the overwhelming number of students who wanted places in high school, that is why we had to be innovative enough to come up with a model that could take in more students.
As we adapt our education systems, seasonal migrants and nomads should also be included in the picture. As we move forward, we need teachers who are trained to support migrant and displaced students as they adapt to new education systems in their host communities.
A que aquí nos reunimos con este grupo de docentes de aquí de Colombia y le vamos explicando un poco la situación de Venezuela. Estos proyectos de sensibilización nos está ayudando a nosotros como docentes.
We foreign teachers bring our culture. We can bring different ideas. We can bring different views and things on society.
মাবর ভালোবাসা পাই না এখানে ওরা পে অনেক অনেক এক্সাইটেড ওরা আমরা ওদেরকে শুধু শিক্ষা ব্যাপারে সচেতন না আমরা ওদের হেলথ সম্পর্কে অনেক সচেতন আসলে.
By ignoring the education of migrants and refugees, we lose out on human potential.
It's only through education that we are able to impart skills to learners. We are able to restore hope to these students.
Saganna bharpur swapna astat mala pan swapna mala pan khup shikaycha motta vaycha pude jaun CID officer banaycha.
Every person has the right to an education. Working together, we must ensure that no one is left behind.
Thank you very much. We have played the video. I wonder if Mr. Bilal is still with us.
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I now would like to give way to Satu Pehuvoima from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to present Finland's commitment and catch us up on the implementation process.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you very much for the invitation to participate this year. I've been participating in the same events a few times before, and I'm really happy to do it, not only because of my present job, but also because of alumni of the University of Jyväskylä. When I first got this invitation and a request to talk about the Finland's response to SDG4 and development cooperation, I thought that other way around. Okay. Is it better now? Okay. I first thought that that this will be a really difficult job because we don't talk about immigration so much in development policy or development cooperation. But maybe I had to spend only 30 seconds thinking about it when I realized that in actual fact we are dealing almost all the time with immigration. But out of the different types of immigration, our work mainly concerns the forced displacement, either the internal displacement within a country or a migration because of forced displacement. And we often then call those people who have to be forcibly displaced, we call them refugees. And you are already saw in the presentation that there are these different types of migration. I selected this picture because it's really important to understand that this issue of migration is a really intersectoral issue. And we cannot separate it from the other parts of the foreign policy or external relations. We have to look at it in connection to the humanitarian work, the crisis management, and all types of political interventions and dialogue in the world. And this, I don't know how well you can see it, but this picture tries to describe that where everywhere Finland is either involved with development cooperation, humanitarian aid, crisis management, and this can be either like civilian crisis management or military crisis management. And you will see that there are these spots all over the world, and this is not even all, like we couldn't including the picture, the smallest maybe non-governmental organizations, projects. And then when you look at it even more carefully, you will see that that development cooperation is often combined with the humanitarian aid and crisis management. And this is this is in many of the countries. Maybe you take the next slide. Put it here as well. Yes. And I started to look at the these countries where Finland has a kind of a long-term major commitment and contribution to development cooperation at the moment and has been for a long period of time. And I tried to figure out that first I started to see like, okay, is there any country where we also are involved with these other types of political or humanitarian or military crisis management? And I realized that it's the total opposite. It's all of the countries where we have to be involved with a very wide spectrum of various activities to work in jointly related to development cooperation. And the reasons in terms of then, or the relationship with education and the this kind of overall stability of the country, which is a factor behind immigration, is the fact that education works for increasing the stability and the function and makes societies functional and promotes democratic development. But then also it can be a factor then when which is threatened as soon as then this the stability is endangered. And we can see that in most of these countries it is the political instability and war or crisis situation that is causing immigration, forced displacement, but in some cases it can also be a natural disaster type of situation, like maybe the latest case here is Mozambique. In Nepal we have had the same situations. And here, there you can see there are like different types of development cooperation activities taking place in these countries, but in those countries, Ethiopia, Myanmar, Afghanistan, Nepal, Mozambique, and Ukraine, we are working between the Finland government and the government of those countries, so we call it like official development aid. In some other countries, the civil society organizations work very actively. This is the case, for example, in Uganda, where there is a large refugee population from other countries, and also there's Jyväskylä University has been working actively in Eritrea, which is also a country in a difficult situation. Maybe you can put the next slide. And this is an example of one of these countries, which is Palestine, where Finland has been cooperating in education for the past 20 years. And you can see that how big a share education has in the support from Finland to Palestine. It's all about 70% of the development cooperation funds of going to Palestine that are allocated to education. And it's also a good example of a situation where we cannot work in education in a vacuum, but we are very, very close to the leaders of the Palestinian territory, and we have to have a very wide look into the overall situation of the country in order to be able to support education there. Maybe we can go to the next one. I think that we can look at all of the different types of, not only the bilateral cooperation that Finland has in many countries of the world, but also the so-called multilateral system where Finland and most other so-called donor countries are collaborating with. And in all of those organizations, we find a relationship to the issue of migration even more so to forced displacement. UNESCO is one of the organizations, as we can see today, with whom we are collaborating. And at the moment, Finland is also a board member of the UNESCO board. With UNESCO, we have a special case that for many years we've been working together in Afghanistan to promote adult literacy, mainly focusing on female literacy. And Afghanistan is, of course, one of the examples where the forced displacement is a huge issue, and the overall crisis situation. We also work together with UNESCO in Myanmar for teacher education. UNICEF is a huge player in education in emergencies, and there, as an example of collaboration, we can mention the No Lost Generation program for education of the Syrian refugee children and youth in Syria and the neighboring countries there. And here I think it's good to highlight the fact that most of the refugees from these countries are not coming to Finland, but they are staying in the nearby countries. So that is an important fact to remember. I think I have to rush because there is not so much time, but all of the, even the multilateral development banks, and particularly the World Bank, and the Global Partnership for Education, are all working in countries where forced displacement is and refugees are a big part of the work. We have to keep in mind that higher education and research are also working for development cooperation, and we have to remember that what the school teachers in Finland do, what we call global citizenship education, is also an important part of the work to promote the SDG4 to be true in 2030. Thanks so much, and sorry for not keeping the time.
Thank you very much. I would like to remind everyone that we have our Flinger session open. The website is flinger.fi, where you can join us. And if you put in the code FK4YELR, then you can post questions that you would like to ask, and then we can go through it with a Q&A. And now I would like to invite Elina Lehtomaki to comment on the report. All of the presentations will be published on the events website and in the Moodle page as well.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to comment on the important report. And I think it's a great pleasure that University of Jyväskylä is launching this report once again here in Finland. It's a national launch. And I think the presentation highlighted important issues in this report. Can you hear me well at the back as well? Thank you. And I think something that I need to ask, we are representing the university community. We have also civil society organizations here. We have Satu Pehu Hoima from the Ministry for Foreign Affairs. We have leadership of our university here, and we do have many issues that we are requested to work in collaboration. We are a research institute, and I think what we need to question is, what is our role here in this process? What are we doing? How do we educate the next generation? How do we solve these issues together? And I would like to remind you of one issue that I think that would maybe add to the presentation, which is recognition of the situation. And I think that was a very important issue of the report. We need to understand the situation. And that is something, as an education and research institute, we need to work on sharing this knowledge and information. How are we doing that? For decades, when I worked in challenging conditions, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, the big issue for me, in collaboration with UNESCO, and maybe in collaboration with Hanna as well, was that how do we share this information? How do we share the reports and the information with our teacher education institutions, with the leaders in society, with the civil society organizations? And I do know that many of our students are active in the student movements, maybe active in climate change initiatives, maybe active in different other kinds of civil society organizations as well. And they will be the future generation of not only problem solvers, but also co-creative knowledge producers, I hope. And I think we all need to do that. And one of the key findings of one of our doctoral students at the University of Oulu was that children and young people who have migrant background often are not recognized, their needs are not recognized. So that's an immediate message to all of us. And I think the report cannot address such very school-level issues, but it provides us an excellent sort of overall picture of the situation, how big the challenge is. We are talking about a huge challenge that affects all our schools and institutions around the world. And I think we need to look at our role as a university, especially as experts when it comes to education. What are we doing as an education and research institute? How do we collaborate? With whom do we collaborate? Whose voice we listen to? And I would like to talk more about that later today. My comment is very short here, but I think the Finnish contribution to solving these issues, even though we heard so many activities, what is happening, I know it's still a very small contribution. We are doing well, as Simon Anholt has said. We are doing globally as well as we can. Our financing to development issues is extremely limited and far too small compared to our economic size, far too small compared to our, what I would say, education knowledge. And I think we are not doing enough in principle. We all do vote. We all do vote wherever we are. And I think we can try to influence through our channels also the decision makers locally, globally. But what we can do at the grassroots level is really recognition of the issues and sharing the knowledge. So this is like a comment and maybe a demand for all of us, including me, myself. And I think what we need to look at is also that what are we doing when we understand the global situation? And how can we produce more knowledge needed, and especially through collaborative ways, including voices of those who have experienced migration? And one final point, which is actually to Bilal at UNESCO, is also that one of the issues that we need to pay attention to is also the question of persons with disabilities in these emerging conflicts, already in the emerging phases. They are the ones who are usually left behind and suffering. If any of you watched news just last night or this morning, there was a picture of a refugee person with disability struggling on his own, left alone somewhere. And this can be the situation often. And I think that is something we in the field of education need to pay attention to. In schools, we have one in eight children has something, often undiagnosed disabilities of different degrees. And when it comes to conflict situations, refugee, migrant situations, and among asylum seekers, we often don't recognize and understand their needs. That concerns UNESCO as well, I would say. And in the report, that is something that is mentioned, but that's something not often shared in presentations because there's multiple challenges. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Barakat, would you like to comment on the issue that was brought up?
Thank you. Specifically on the question of refugees with disabilities. Well, first of all, let me say that I appreciate the commentary. I think you're spot on generally with the situation and our role in drawing attention to the issue and also the limitations of sort of going into down to the classroom level in for different countries and the role that higher education or local experts play in this dialogue and the reflection, your reflection that you're having today on how to translate and contextualize these findings. I think that's all spot on. Regarding the specific question on disabilities, there, you're absolutely right, and there is actually a section in the report specific to that. One reason we didn't maybe gave it a bit less emphasis than you think it merits is that actually the report we're working on now, the 2020 report, is on the theme of inclusion and inclusive education. So we knew that there was there would be a big room given to that topic in the upcoming report. I hope you're looking forward to that. We're very hard at work at making it a valuable resource also, including. So we take the broadest possible view of inclusion. It's not at all limited to learners and people with disabilities, but of course that is a big part of it.
Thank you very much. And now I would like to invite Mary Helsten to comment on the report.
That. Usually my voice carries, but let's see. This crackles a bit, but you can hear me okay now. Mary Helsten from Stockholm University. Thank you so much for inviting me to once again join our gathering. And together with our students, we have seven of us here enjoying the engagement. 9 years. I'm going to just be very short. I'm going to give some reflections, mainly on what we have listened to this morning, knowing that time is ticking away and we need to move on to the next things on the program. 9 years. 9 years of reveling in the diversity and unity across borders. That is something to be celebrated. And I celebrate UVascular University for doing that and for establishing this momentum. The goals are there to promote sustainability across the educational curriculum and across from formal to informal educational settings. But I am wondering, how do we safeguard this? We need to reverse the power and the responsibility dynamic from children and childhood to responsible adults. If we listen to Greta and her fury at the lack of responsibility that she experiences from the adult community, that is a wake-up call to us all, I think. The world climate, I'm thinking, is asking citizens to question our values towards displacement, involuntary migration, and seeking refuge. This cuts across the board of education. Is it a quest to be handed down from us, the older generation, to the young? Or should it be the other way around? There is a lot for us to think about. How do we work across the curriculum to promote and provide support? Can we show by example? What would Greta have to say about that? On social sustainability, we need to transfer it from system level to the individual. So I would urge us to ask, what can I do to contribute? What can I do to contribute in my everyday dealings, in my lessons, in my teaching, in my social engagements, in my private life? What can I do to contribute here and now, in this room and outside, and so on? So taking it from the system level to the individual level is important for us, in us to enact change. And this reminds me of Simon Unfold's Countries to People. I'm thinking here of the United Nations, the people and the planet. The people and the planet need to work in unison. We need to work together. We only have this one planet. You know that statement, there is no planet B. On Bilal, and Bilal talks about those who are left behind, and that one in eight people live in foreign locations. And here I hear the binary, the educational binary of vulnerability and strength. How can education respond? How do we provide security in the face in the face of unrest in the world? Displacement affects education across all levels, from early childhood to higher education. And specifically, since I've been asked to comment on Nordic higher education and the situation in the Nordic higher education field, we have come a long way in the Nordic higher education, as the results are showing that have been reported on here today. But there is still a lot of work to be done. Scholars are still not gaining access to higher education, also in the Nordic countries. Scholars continue being persecuted, even in their host countries, and I'm going to talk about that in my talk later on. The work of SARS, some of you might have recognized that. I'll come back to that. We know from research that entry into a higher education job by a skilled higher education lecturer, someone who has undergone a disputation and has a doctoral degree, is still needing work to be done. There are many highly educated academics that remain outside the higher education employment sector and end up working in different employment sectors. And we need to work on that, particularly in the Nordic countries. This is an important quest for us. Simultaneously, there is a lack of skilled labor in higher education. We lack 70,000 skilled teachers in Sweden at the moment. How do we recognize that? How do we reconcile these binaries and these differences? And then we have in Europe and in the Nordic countries something that has been mentioned as a nationalistic movement. We are seeing examples of this in Denmark, in the Denmark higher education community, where, for example, the access of international student mobility has been drastically limited. These issues are serious, and we need to deal with them, and we need to deal with them now together. I think I might leave it there. Just some reflections. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the comments. Mr. Barakat, do you have anything to add to this observation?
Thank you. I don't think there was a particular question there for me. So let me just sort of agree with what was said broadly. I think one of the issues I do want to emphasize, though, is that one of the things we really try to do with the report was to make sure that we're not just talking about refugees and that it doesn't come across as being sort of a refugee and education report, but that we wanted to highlight that, as we heard earlier from another speaker also, actually migration is everywhere. The forced migration, it receives the most headlines and it is associated with some of the most urgent needs and some of the biggest challenges. But in terms of the share of migration, it's relatively small. And so we shouldn't forget about issues of rural to urban migration and what that means in some countries of the global south. Those issues are actually almost indistinguishable from international migration, where in urban slums you have internal migrants who also speak very different languages from the main language in the city, have sort of potentially very different cultural background, have similar issues around recognition and certification and documentation. There are limits on internal migration in many countries. In China is a famous example, and even with recent reforms, we found that to register for a rural migrant in Beijing to register their child in a school, they needed 5 different pieces of sort of paperwork. So there is that issue. I'm glad the question of student migration came up, because that's also a big topic, so highly skilled migration, student migration, and what that means for education systems, not just in host countries, but also in sending countries, in terms of brain drain and gain and circulation and all these things. So I'm glad that sort of all the different topics are being picked up to some extent. And I would encourage you to sort of have that broad discussion.
We will carry on with the discussion, and we would like to have you for another few minutes.
Absolutely.
We have a very international, education-minded audience here, and I would like to invite them. Yes, we can turn it around. Can you see us?
Yes, I can. Hello.
So we would like to invite the audience to ask some questions from us, and I would like to invite my two wonderful technicians to help with the microphones. Thank you. So is anybody have a question? There were some hands in the air earlier. Yes. Please show your hand again so our assistant can give you the microphone.
Hey, I am Sam, studying at JYU. A big thank you to all the speakers that have presented so far. My question is around the focus on literacy and numeracy repeatedly over the years. Does the heavy focus on literacy and numeracy lead to indigenous and traditional non-academic knowledge, skills, and practices getting neglected? And could indigenous small-scale vocational establishments be valuable to sustainable development, employment, and social integration? Was my question audible?
Did you hear the question?
I did. I think I did. Are we collecting questions or am I responding directly?
It's more of a Q&A with a question answer.
Okay. You're absolutely right that that is one of the big controversial issues and has been since, you know, certainly since the agenda was being discussed, what it meant for the headline goal or headline target to be operationalized in terms of fairly narrowly in terms of literacy or reading and numeracy specifically. It's a complex issue. On the one hand, there is certainly some truth to it that we have a lot of research and a lot of literature exposing, you know, teaching to the test and all those kinds of issues and how and also the highlighting the importance of other cognitive skills, of non-cognitive skills, both for education and beyond education. There's also an acknowledgement to some extent of that elsewhere in the agenda, but that's always hampered by sort of a lack of agreed measurement and indicators. With the learning focus, the other issue is, though, that it is important to, when we see figures showing coming out of recent learning assessments, including in particular sort of household survey-based that include out-of-school children in low-income countries, not just school-based tests that only test children who are in school to begin with. But if we look at the broader picture, and we see that in some countries, you know, 50%, 60%, 70%, 80% of children of primary school leaving age can't actually read, are not functionally reading, even at a level expected of, you know, in grade two or three, then that does tell us something, and it does tell us something important. And it, in particular, it tells us something about those furthest behind. It's sort of, I think we need to interpret it really as minimum requirements and minimum levels, and treat it as an early warning signal. Well, not early. It's late, but as a warning signal, as a red flag that something is going seriously wrong. But in terms of how we arrive at that data and what kind of assessments we do, I think a lot of this discussion you'll find in the 2017-18 report on accountability, on the difference between sort of sample-based assessments at the national level to monitor, you know, systemically what's going wrong, where are things improving, or where are the gaps and where are communities falling further behind. And that kind of information doesn't necessarily even trickle back into the classroom. And that's quite a different use of reading and numeracy, literacy and numeracy data, than sort of having a whole scale national assessment that everyone takes that determines people's further educational opportunities, whether they're tracked into university-bound general education or into vocational, whether it's tied to performance-based pay for teachers, that kind of thing. That's a very different conversation, and I think that's much more contentious than at the global level, at the national level, as a diagnostic monitoring tool, focusing on reading and numeracy specifically as relatively well-defined and relatively easier to measure than non-cognitive skills and other cognitive skills, as a diagnostic tool to really raise the red flags on where large-scale systemic change appears to be necessary.
Thank you very much. We have time for two more questions. Is there anyone in the audience who have a question? No. We also have a flinger going. And there's one. Sorry.
Hello. Thank you very much for your time today. My name is Aaron, and my question is concerned with fiscal responsibility. I think it seems to be a critical issue in financial support, especially in more disadvantaged states and nations. And I think the 2017 August report briefly mentions the issue. I think it mentions how in Nigeria there were ghost teachers because they were trying to get funds, but that wasn't actually the case. They didn't have that many teachers. And looking at the 2019 report, it does highlight, in my opinion, quite well the financial implications across various states and nations. But I'm just wondering, what kind of system is there for checking the responsibility of the funds that are received from the World Bank or other international organizations and how that's allocated internally in a country? If that makes sense.
I'm sorry. The question was how that is tracked?
Yes, in essence, yeah. How are the funds that are allocated from different organizations, how are they properly tracked?
That's an important and difficult question. I think the answer will be that there's huge. There are differences in country contexts in how well that's tracked. In the accountability report, the 2017-18 report, as you said, I think there is some discussion around that, not around sort of. Transparency of that and corruption and those issues, where that gets lost. I think the answer is that systematically at the global level, it's not, right? So we are struggling to track where the funds at the global level come from in the first place and where they're going. So even that information isn't complete, and it's a lot of work just compiling that, sort of who's funding the multilaterals and how much of it is going to education, how much of it that is labeled as going to education is actually going to education, what we would recognize as education on the ground. So then the next step at the flows within countries, I don't think there's a universal answer to that. There is too little accountability in that respect. What we find working on the inclusion report, for example, one of the issues we look at is the extent to which donor funds are supposedly earmarked for inclusive education, or potentially even for to support learners with disabilities. And what we find is that with respect to that, for example, there is very little tracking then in the end of the extent to which that actually happened, right? And it's difficult, it's extremely difficult to say how much of that volume was actually spent on inclusive education, how many learners with disabilities actually benefited from that. It's a big challenge. I'm sorry, I don't have a good satisfactory answer to that.
Thank you very much for your answer. We don't really have time for more questions, so I would just like to ask you if you could pick one thing for our participants. What should we do to start working right now within our community, at the university and in our local communities, to help humanity achieve the SDG 4 goals by 2030? Just one thing.
The questions are getting more and more difficult. So I can't answer that for you. I think what you're doing, that you're meeting here today to have this discussion, and with your contextual knowledge and knowing your connections and knowing what the levers are in Finland in particular, I think that's sort of the multiplier that we're trying to achieve. So having having this discussion, having it as a public discussion, carrying this discussion and these debates back into your classrooms and your homes and your social circles, I think that's that'll be my answer.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for your time and the presentation. It was lovely to have you. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much. Have a good one. Bye.
We are a little bit behind schedule, but I would like to invite you all to have a little bit of stretch break. Sitting for 3 hours is too long, not just for the children, but for us as well. So please walk around a little. We have the 17 SDG goals or the areas on post-it notes on the windows. We will have a lovely volunteer stand next to it. And we would like you to think about it. If you have any thoughts, any observations, any goals that you would like to achieve in that area, and please make a note of it. You can make it in your own language or in English. Yes, also, if you haven't signed up for a workshop, please do so now. Thank you. Just one more thing. Let's meet back here at 25 past. So 11:25, we start again. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Can you hear me? Good day to everyone. And welcome to my presentation. I am Gloria Lapitan, working in Multicultural Center Gloria. And I am from the Philippines, and I've been working, I have been here in Finland for almost 27 years. And I consider myself as an immigrant too. So, with this in mind, we have this Multicultural Center Gloria, which is, of course, under my name, but I don't own this. Yeah, and it is located there, of course, in Mataran 6, under this Activity Center Mataram. So we are open from Monday to Thursday, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., and as you can see, it's one of our opening remarks as always. Gloria is an open international meeting, and also for you. It's not for everyone, the immigrants. And immigrants, when you we say that they are returnees, foreigners, refugees, and also Finnish at the same time. So we call it Multicultural Center. Because in the beginning, when I was working in this different project, they always say that Multicultural Center is only for the foreigners or for the immigrant. But I would say that it would be for everyone, especially those people living here in Jyväskylä. And the Finnish are also considered as a part of this center, because we have different cultures, and in that way we could also be a part of it. And where are they? The background. Go down. Because I'm looking at this. So the second slide. Okay. So it is an open international or multicultural forum. It was started operating in 2008, April, and Gloria was opened to meeting place in January 2009 in Kaupakatu. It is a non-governmental organization under the administering us is administrator is Central Finland Association, or we call it Keskisuomen Yhteisön Tuki, acted as our administrator till the end of 2016. Because 2017, we decided to become an association. So now we have Multicultural Center Gloria Association. And in the beginning, we were only funded by this slot machine association, which is this Raha Automat Udistus. But then after 3 years, the city decided to put also funding for us. So until the present, now it's called STEA, and the city is funding our activities. Okay? So when we talk about Gloria, we have different activities, which includes youth work, family, language groups, volunteers. And volunteers have a big impact on us because they are the one who helped us in the different activities that we start, and advocacy. And aside from those, the daily activities, we also arrange events, which is one big event that we are celebrating every year is this Gloria Independence Day celebration, which is on the 5th of December this year in Jyväskylän Julasali. Yes. So if you are available, it's open to everyone. It's from 2 to 4 o'clock. And aside from these different projects that we have, we also have this Info Gloria, wherein if you need some help, especially for those immigrants or maybe the foreigners too who has been living here and then they have some problems regarding their papers in their school or in the way of their, daily routine or whatever, they can come to Gloria, and we have different advisors there too. We will could see it later on. And then we have a place that you could rent or offer. We offer for, especially for these international groups, and we have it Saturday, Sundays, and sometimes weekdays. So as you can see, Gloria is easily accessible and open to meeting place. It means that you can come and reserve place for us, and then we could see the place that is available if you want to put up some activities there. And language group. Our main, the basic that we have is this Finnish language learning. It's not a course, but it is the way of learning the language basically. After that, because when we talk about language, it would take an immigrant who comes to Finland cannot easily be admitted in some courses or go to school. But we tried that in Gloria. They could come first as a basic place wherein they could meet people, learn the language, and also develop their sense of self-confidence that there is a place where they are all welcome. So that's one. And then we have family groups. It's every Friday. We have this family, Moni Mesi family group. And it is 2 hours every day, every Friday. And as I said, volunteer work. It's very, very important for us because we have only, how many, six workers being paid. And most of our activities are from 9 to 4 o'clock is based on volunteer work, especially our language, Finnish language. And Finnish language is volunteers who are teachers are retirees. And they are Finnish teachers, and they are expert in their own profession. So, and also it's not only the Finnish language, but it's also we have Persian language, those who are interested. We have Arabic, and also some Latin languages, Latin like Spanish, or they're in Latin countries. We give them time to 5 times if they could participate. And of course, our English group is by Vicky, who is now also our volunteer there in Gloria.
It used to be by me, but now we have another lovely volunteer, Eleni, who is the leader of the English conversation group on Mondays.
Yes, and also sometimes our one French lady who is now also a retiree last Monday. And so events and occasion projects. Gloria has within Gloria we have lots of projects, especially for the youth. And we have cooperation work with different schools, the university, also the other institutions. And of course, the other churches. And sometimes we have some, they ask us to do some cooperation work in different countries, like the latest was in Poland, and the Solbus project, which is concerning the nursing students in Jyväskylän Applied Sciences. And also youth group from, we have it in Poland, and one is in, the last one they were able to have it in, Germany, at Potsdam, in Potsdam. Yeah, then maybe. So, and you can see now those different, our goal is to support multicultural groups and build an open and equal forum to support communality and sustainable development. And this will come now as with this how this the what is this the theme of SDG 4. And to act as a mediator, create and strengthen multicultural network. And values we have, when we talk about values, we also ask comments from our participants. And it came out this respect, equality, open-mindedness, accepting diversity, justice, and humanity. So now I'm talking earlier about InfoGloria, and it is a... there would be some guidance, advisors who could help in, for example, about education, work, residency, permit, living, and social and other issues. Information is in English, Russian, Persian, Thai, Arabic, and that's all. So this is the schedule of our InfoGloria. And if you are interested in those who need advice, you're always welcome. And here are our advisors. This Persian is there you could see, and then Russian, Thai, and Lao, and then Arabic. And the main advisor is Marit Perus Delano. And these are our workers, our employees there in Gloria. And welcome to Gloria. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
You're welcome. Take the microphone back.
Thank you very much, Gloria. Do we have any quick questions? If not, you can always visit Gloria and Matarankatu. Yes, we have one question.
The volunteering opportunity is every... you can come on Wednesdays, that you could be guided, and then you could apply for it. And then any... it depends on what we don't require you to have the whole day or every day, but what is your what do you like to activities do you like to volunteer, or if you want to start with another group, like for example, what language do you speak?
Arabic.
Oh, so you can come and be an Arabic teacher. And so today, by the way, we have this language cafe. You know what it's a language cafe is, isn't it? Yes, and we have at starts at 5 o'clock. Welcome. And about yesterday, we were able to count 11. We have our teachers, Finnish teachers, students who were, who came to visit us, and then we were singing the Finnish language, and we have 11 different languages to say hello in the country where you come from and say hello in your own language. And we have 11. And if you are interested today, you come to Gloria.
And another quick question?
Just a comment to say that it's great that you have a center where you welcome
everyone
from different cultural backgrounds. And if I were immigrant here, I would feel very welcome. So
yes.
I think it's great that you...
Yes. And we have different... different activities too, that which is like, for example, language at lunch at Gloria. We invite we prepare ethnic food. It's once a month, but we would be starting by January again. And you can visit us, and then you can participate with us in our Gloria Independence Day celebration. It's here in university. And another question?
Sadly, we are running a little bit behind, but thank you very much. And now I would like to invite Mary Helsten to give us her presentation on sustainable internationalization in higher education. Okay, now let's see. So you'll give me, are you going to...
I will assist.
You'll assist with the
presentation.
Oh. How does that sound? Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, rightio. So once again, thank you so much for the invitation. It is a pleasure to be here. I am starting to lose track, but I think this is the fourth year that I'm contributing to this wonderful event, and I am coming from Stockholm University, and on behalf of us, my students in the Master Program for Comparative and International Education at Stockholm University, we also thank you for the invitation. It's a great opportunity for us to take part in this. I just want to say a couple of things about our master program. I just learned recently, I was asked to describe, tell a little bit about it, but I found that it is
the oldest master program provided in the English language at Stockholm University. It is 50 years old. And it is also the fourth most popular program currently in provided in the English language at the university. And it is something that we, I guess, are a little bit proud of. It makes us just a little bit taller, makes us stand tall in being able to educate students from all over the world. We have about 40 to 50 students every year, and they really cover all the continents of the globe, and all the instruction is conducted in the English language. But that is not what I'm here to talk about today, although sustainable internationalization goes hand in hand with what I do. My living and breathing is international higher education. It is also my research area. I am particularly interested in taking a critical view on internationalization. What is it actually? So today I'm going to talk about how education must respond to the changes in society, because after all, that is all that education is. It is all that education is. It is a response to society's needs, right? If we look at it from a social point of view. But how do we bridge this with the SDGs in higher education and the higher education's role and contribution to society? We know, and here at this event, we're talking about the social, cultural, economic, and environmental sustainability in higher education. And I'm asking, how can higher education and sustainability interact for the common good? The public university, are we talking about equity, to do it equitably, to do it by practicing inclusion, to do it by maintaining quality in what we do? I'm going to be talking a little bit about the government reforms that are working hard in trying to meet the needs of society. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the humanitarian initiatives in higher education. I'm going to tie that then with the student issues and finish off hopefully with suggesting a holistic approach to looking at sustainable international higher education. But let us turn to the words. Words have meanings. Words are a way for us to understand the world around us. Our understanding rests on the use and understanding of language as a code. So sustainability then, I went and had a look at the synonyms of sustainability. And here we have a few. They are synonyms for sustainable, sustainability education, environmental education, education for sustainable development, so educational development, education for sustainability, and education for sustainable future or futures. All of this implies a transformation of social, cultural, economic, and environmental capacities in society. Is it a sustaining of something over time, or is it a sustaining of quality? And traditionally, sustainability has really dealt with the survival, the necessary survival of the people and the planet. So this prompted me to, being a comparativist, we compare within and across. And history is always a comparative aspect. We need to know where we are coming from in order to know where we are and in order to know where we are going in the future. And so I had a look. Where did sustainability begin? Where did it start? And I was able to trace it. You might be able to trace it further than this, and I'm sure that we can. But this is where I ended up. So in the 18th century, as it were, Karlowitz in the Saxony forests, in the mining industry, coined the term sustainability, according to some records. And I would hope that you can challenge that and perhaps find an older record of that. And then we moved across to the 1800s or the 19th century with sustainability being part of the industrialization and the skilled jobs conflict. The slavery was abolished, and in the 20th century, philanthropy was born. And there, large philanthropic sustainable organizations such as the Carnegie and Rockefeller organizations were launched. And of course, in the post-Second World War reconstruction efforts, more organizations took on sustainability issues in terms of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the United Nations work, and so on. And of course, that is continuing until today. There is an important work that is being cited, which for our students who might not have come across it, and that is the book called The Silent Spring, which was really about the use of pesticides in the environment and the environmental damage that pesticides were created, and that came out in 1962, if I'm not mistaken. So the Silent Spring and the industrial, so sustainability in terms of looking at industrial pollution, the Equal Pay Act, a lot of emphasis on clean air and water. The Earth Day event was born in the 1970s. And of course in the 80s it grew to encompass the concerns for the ozone crisis, oil spills, environmental disasters, and you can see how it's escalating in the 90s and, of course, into our current century, where we have the United Nations working with the Global Compact and the Paris Climate Agreement in 1915. So this is just to provide perspective. What does perspective give us? It gives us the knowledge that it is not a new thing that we are dealing with, trying to save our planet and trying to save the people that need to live and learn on our planet. So looking back, then to on the policy side, and this is particularly of value for us interested in higher education's task in society. In 2012, OECD came out with a report that is a strategy for managing institutional practice in international higher education, which gave five reasons to universities to internationalize. And let's have a look at those very, very briefly, very quickly. To prepare student preparedness for the changes in global society was the uppermost important task of universities, according to the OECD. The second most important task was to internationalize curriculum. And the third one, to enhance the international profile of the institution. The fourth, to strengthen research and knowledge production through internationalization. All of these
are aspects of sustaining higher education, sustaining education, and how it filters through to society and society's needs. And, of course, to diversify faculty and staff. In order for universities to be able to deliver, we need to have a diverse faculty. We need to have diverse staff. And sustainability seems to come up to level. It seems to pop up when there is scarcity in society, when resources are identified as being lacking or scarce. And this is an interesting statement. It is an economic statement that I'm hoping we can discuss and challenge. How am I going with time? Am I running? Okay, I'll run through the rest very quickly. Okay. So, the academic community of scholars began reacting towards internationalization of higher education, not as the shining activity delivering good quality education to a few, to an elite few, the 5% of the world population that were able to take part in mobility and take their studies elsewhere through stipends and private financing and so on. In the 1980s, many of the studies by international scholars, Wole and Ang, Biggs and others, reported on the deficit model, how internationalization created a deficit model. And there was a backlash in the 90s and the 2000s from the community of scholars that believe in internationalization as a common good, as something that delivers cultural understanding, reciprocal relationships, equity, and so on. And so we went out in the beginning of the 2000s and asked the global community across all continents to give us examples of what works, what can be celebrated in international higher education, thinking about the sustainability factor across time and across quality. And we found four areas of implementation, dealing with internationalizing curriculum as a need, using technology to reach across borders, working with student engagement, which is so important, engaging our students in active learning, and using language, working with ESL, EFL, EMI, English Medium Instruction Delivery of Higher Education as a sustainability measure. Further on, there was a large body of research where the academic community of those scholars, the community of academic scholars who were interested in the common good of public higher education and delivering good quality public education also to the international education sector. I'm just going to mention very briefly that here in Finland, a famous study was conducted at Oulu University by Vanessa Andriotti and a group of up to 30 universities all around the world, of which I was part of the Swedish consortium group, on ethical internationalization, asking what collective imaginaries are conjured up by the discourse that we collect and that we hear and that we can observe in international higher education around the world. And the discourses were grouped as based on the data that was gathered across these universities from the level of students up to the level of management
and human resources, we were able to develop interfaces between a liberal discourse, a neoliberal discourse, and a critical discourse that created social imaginaries of what internationalization and international higher education should be and what it is. But somewhat less on the critical, which is what we would have wanted more of. So this was one of the outcomes of that. I just want to now very quickly talk a little bit about how governments are responding. Globalization affects us all, and it is the government's task, I guess, to direct universities to deliver on the global imperatives. And universities are therefore put in a place where they will need to respond to the globalization imperatives. And there is vigorous work conducted across universities all around the world, but more so perhaps in the Nordic countries. It is like the Nordic countries have woken up to internationalization, or perhaps to the liberalization, or perhaps to the neoliberal commodification ideas of higher education. You decide. But the research shows, as we mentioned in the ethical internationalization study, that there is somewhat less emphasis on the critical, which is what we believe that the university ought to be doing. We ought to be the conscience of society, where ideas are free, where we can build on learning and curiosity and interpersonal relations, and where we can do good. Okay? So, in Sweden, I'm just going to whiz through this. We are in the midst of national reform. Sweden has decided in 2017 to reform higher education with a national strategy for internationalization of higher education. And I'm happy to see that it is actually building on the SDGs. So in Sweden, we haven't lost our way entirely. I'm happy to observe. A lot of the reform work, the government inquiry, and the suggestions made, which have not been ratified as yet, but which will take form starting next year, if it goes through Parliament, then many of the sustainability values are built in to delivering international higher education in Sweden across all universities. Just a few bit of details. You can look it up if you Google SOU 2018:3. You will find the report there. It suggests a new Higher Education Act. And here you can see the change that is being suggested and how closely it ties in with the sustainability goals. So universities' collective international activities shall contribute towards strengthened quality of education and research and towards sustainable national and global development. That's a lovely higher education law, I think. But it hasn't been ratified as yet. We're dreaming. We keep dreaming and hoping. It has, and I'm just going to then whiz through the structure of it, just very quickly. Okay, there we have. It has, you can just see the objectives. It is a vision. It has visions, and it has eight main objectives, and we move on. to the next slide. And here you can see the final report. Thank you. And you can read the final report, which was published on the 30th of October last year. The universities have been given recommendations, and we all universities, including Stockholm University, is now very busy. And from the Higher Education Teaching and Learning Centre at Stockholm University, I am leading the work on how Stockholm University will implement the internationalization strategy into the teaching and learning across the university. So we're looking at ways to translate the policy into actionable action. I'm very nearly done. So in the next slide, I'm just going to flash up the objectives and their targets. And you can see, get a flavor for the comprehensive nature of this national reform. Okay, we'll go on, and that continues on, and we'll go to the next one. So I now want to mention something about what this means for enacting curriculum. Curriculum is understood as the teaching, everything to do with teaching, including the objectives and the policies, but also the practices of teaching, and therefore also the learning by students. So when we talk about sustainable internationalization, we talk about sustainable curriculum by involving students, by engaging students, by building on relationality between the academic community, the faculty, and the student body. And I'm hoping that our students who are visiting you here today will be able to give you examples of how we intend to do this, how we strive towards building on that openness, relationality, the facilitation of learning, rather than a top-down teacher-led curriculum delivery option. So here we need to align the curriculum with the sustainable goals. We need to saturate the curriculum with intercultural and international content. And we need to utilize lecturers' international mobility. We need to have more mobility. We need to inspire our students to visit other universities in other countries. And we need to invite guests into our courses, into the curriculum. And there are simple ways that we can do that through creating virtual mobility periods. What I do in my courses readily is I invite my colleagues. Elena has recently given a short lecture in my courses. It is easy to do when we have the technology. We do not need to travel across the world. But of course, when that is not available to us, I'm not saying that all countries and all societies and cultures have technology available to them. And where it is not available, we need to work towards enabling internationalization to embed the cultural content into our curriculum. And we need to recycle the curriculum. We need to follow up. We need to discuss what we have done. We need to reflect on how we have done it. We need to ask ourselves, as scholars, how did I go? Did that work? What didn't work? What can I change? And be open towards change. Because, after all, that is what we're here for as educators, to make change. I just want to say a few things about the other side of sustainable internationalization, which deals with humanitarian incentives. And I want to just have a heads up. I think it's the next one, humanitarian incentives. Oh, there it is. Okay. Right here. So How many of you have heard about scholars at risk? Some of us, okay. And the rest of you will now Google it, and then you will have heard about it, and next time you will be able to put your hand up. So it is an organization with over 500 linked higher education institutions across many countries that provides a sanctuary for academics who feel persecuted, who feel that they have no access, who need safety and security. And it is an international organization. If you are interested in this, Stockholm University is part of the organization, as I believe is Jyväskylä, I think. In Finland, there are 15 higher education institutions that are also part of it. And, of course, organizations such as these need volunteers. So if this is your call, there is work to do. Okay, so we move on then to finalize. I've got my last two slides. Opportunities for sustainable internationalization. My students and my colleagues often ask, my colleagues who are also my students in the higher education, teaching and learning, professional development context, ask me, give me some concrete tips on what to do. What can I do? So in a paper that I worked with John Buchanan at UTS in Sydney on where we question internationalization for indigenous peoples across the world and the sustainability of that idea or not. Is it an okay thing to do to ask our indigenous populations to enter into the international cultural context and perhaps find themselves even more marginalized in their host culture than they are already in their majority culture? We think about the Sami people, which we have here in our own countries, in the Nordic countries. We think about the Aboriginal, indigenous Aboriginals. We think about the Ano people in Japan. We think about there are indigenous populations all across. And we suggest, as part of that research, that perhaps we need to create a local return value on international mobility to validate internationalization locally. What does it mean, locally? So to contextualize international mobility with local cultures for a transitional balance, so that international mobility does not just stay as a mobility, but that it is brought back into the culture, the local culture, and embedded into the local culture. And there are twofold to this return value, where one, the value needs to be identified before the exchange takes place. So we need to talk about these values. And it needs to be mutually constructive, but it also needs to constitute a non-coercive practice, an investment for exchange across cultures. So we started with the question, how can universities respond equitably and justly to the imperatives imposed by globalization, remember? I'm ending up with one photograph. This is from a recent conference that we organized in International Comparative Education at Stockholm University, which also launched the Global CIE Forum, a new global forum consisting of comparativists and comparative researchers. And here, it was a very successful conference, but we managed to get the notable dignitaries in the field from 25 countries to come to Stockholm for 2 days to share their research experiences. Comparative education has been criticized for being too tied to the nation state and too tied to big data types of research and quantitative positivist research. We wanted to change that because the world is changing. This is important. So for the occasion, we designed a different type of program that embraced also the post-colonial perspectives, which are part and always have been part of comparative education. And to open the occasion, I took the opportunity to wear my cultural Sami outfit, which is what you see there. As Sami people, we need to validate our background. We need to be visibly what we are. We need to show our roots. We need to show our heritage. Because without our heritage, what are we? I'll end up there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mary. And before we break for lunch, please could we welcome one of the representatives of Pime Cafe who will talk to us about what is available in the cafe?
Yes, I got the microphone in front.
Okay.
Yes.
Hello. Is this the way to hold the microphone, I hope? You can all hear me. My name is Riikka, and I'm working in the dark cafe, Pime Cafe, which... I have the feeling you only hear the pops, but not what I say. What's the right way to hold this thing?
Further down. It's
okay. Like the, yeah, now it's good. Now it's good. Yeah, we are in the second floor. I mean, one floor above here. There are, I guess, there are good signs guiding to the place, and people can also guide you to the place. It's the dark cafe, and it's literally what it said. It's dark there. I'm blind myself, and working there. And if you visit the cafe, you can spend a moment. You can have one like coffee break in a blind person's world. It's really dark, no lights there. We have coffee, tea, and juice, and some little sweet things to that. And I hope you will all come and visit our cafe, because it's a little bit a different kind of coffee break. So my heartiest welcome to the dark cafe today till 4 o'clock afternoon, and tomorrow from 11 to 4 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Two more quick notes. We have Isaac representatives in the hallway who would love to talk to you about the volunteering opportunities. And there's also still time to sign up for the workshops. And now it is lunch break. Please remember that it's not only UNO where you can go and have lunch. If there's a really long queue, we also have restaurants available in every university building, some of which are a very quick walk away. Okay, we will continue with the seminar at 20 past one to give everyone enough time to have lunch and visit the cafe if they wish so. Thank you.